The master was leaning over the grand piano, talking with the half-American piano player from Tokyo. Tomo was one of a generation of post-war babies, American fathers, Japanese mothers, outcasts from Japanese society. Many grew up orphans, under bridges and street gangs. Now they'd found a home in the entertainment industry. And though they were still called Ainoko behind their backs, love trouble child, they were some of the country's most loved entertainers. The master's name was Koichi. Nobody called him that. He was the maitre d' of the supper club his sister ran. His title was master, so we simply called him Master. Only Una, his sister, occasionally addressed him more familiarly as Kochan. Kochan, like Willie for William, was a nickname of childhood affection. Master was leaning over the grand piano, smiling at the piano player from Tokyo. Una was escorting the last pair of weaving drunks to a taxi at the front door. Arm in arm in their gray business suits, shirt collars open, ties hanging from their pockets, shoes barely on, heels broken down, they clung to each other, a vine and a chicken wire fence as they wove their way through air and invisible obstacles like slow-mo backfield runners. It was the nightly ritual of her most valued customers. I was sitting at a table, talking with the manager of the piano player, Ricky, waiting to have a nightcap with Una before hailing my own cab. "Want to go Gayobaru?" the manager asked. "Huh?" I said, not understanding where he wanted me to go. "Gayobaru, ikimashouka." "Ikimashouka," I understood. "Shall we go?" I still looked puzzled. "Gayobaru, after-hours club. Geisha. Master and Tomo going." He nodded toward the piano. I often pretended to understand words I really didn't know, shaking my head as a good Japanese, merely acknowledging having heard them, hoping I could put together enough of the context to figure out the meaning. "You come, ne?" "Okay," I said. "If Master and Tomo were going, and I'd never seen geisha." Just then Una came to the table. "Mizo wari?" she asked. I nodded. She called up to Chief, the bartender upstairs, for 2 Johnny Walkers and water. The manager spoke with her in Japanese. I was watching Master and Tomo laughing at the piano and paying no attention to their conversation when I heard again the unfamiliar word, Gayobaru. Una turned to me, a worry spread across her face.
"Honto ni rinda? Gayobaru ikimashou ka?"
"You know, Gayobaru means..." I still must have looked perplexed, because she said it again, slowly, louder.
Gayobaru.
She paused to read my face.
"Ego, English," she said.
"English," I protested.
"So desho, gayobaru."
And then added, "Boy and boy, together." It wasn't simply that the words gay bar were Japanized, or out of context. I'd never heard the term gay. I didn't know it was English slang for homosexual. But suddenly I knew the meaning. "Oh," I said, slightly embarrassed. "Gayobaru," like I knew it all along. Did they tell about me? Were they taking me there because they could tell I was... I couldn't think the word. Judy and I were just good friends. Though I had proposed to her in my own way when I begged her to come to Japan. Maybe there was something they could sense about me. Maybe this was supposed to be a gift for me. I wasn't sure what was expected. "Well," I said, "it's very late," trying to refuse, knowing a refusal is never a refusal.
"Ikimashou, let's go," cajoled the manager. "No women there, Master Tomo busy, you I talk."
"Well, why are you going then?" I asked naively.
"Master Tomo needs chaperone."
"Oh," I nodded, not wanting to be rude or hurtful. "I'll go then." The commotion that acceptance caused was unprecedented in my 6 months in Saga, perhaps in my entire 2 years. Una rose from the table without touching her drink. She crossed the dance floor to the piano and huddled with Master and Tomo. They spoke in whispers. Half an hour passed with them in huddle. Finally, Chief was asked to call a cab. Tomo, Master, Ricky, and I were escorted into the chill October street by Una, whose frail smile couldn't mask an anxiety I didn't comprehend. Master, Tomo, and Ricky sat in the back of the cab. I sat in the front with the driver. Ricky gave directions.
"Hi, hi."
nodded the driver.
We swung around the corner of the entertainment district onto a street I didn't know. It was narrow, but well lighted. Its businesses shuttered against the night. A woman stood in a pool of light near a doorway. She was young, heavily made up, and red blonde. The shade, blue-black Asian hair, goes under peroxide. She was wearing a black miniskirt and a revealing lace blouse. We had passed her when Ricky called the driver to stop. There was some discussion between Ricky and Tomo. Ricky spoke again to the driver, who backed the cab up the narrow street to the woman. He got out to speak with her. In a few moments, she came to the rear window, wearing Ricky's raincoat, and smiled. Master slid out of the back seat. She slid in next to Tomo. Then Master slid back in. Ricky got in the front seat with me.
"Iku,
go," he said to the driver.
"Hi, hi."
And we continued along the narrow street. I was confused. I thought I'd finally figured that we were going to a queer bar, men only, for Tomo and Master, and now they sat with a prostitute between them. I glanced in the rearview mirror. Tomo reached his hand out across the girl's lap, where Master's hand met it, and the rain-coated woman placed her hands over theirs in camouflage. My heart sank. I looked away quickly, hoping they hadn't seen me. All of the commotion at the club was fear. Fear that I would know or tell the secret. My presence meant that they had to pretend, in the cab, at the gay Obaro, that they weren't gay. I wanted desperately to shout that it was okay, that I was. But I didn't know the word. I said nothing as we turned through the narrow streets. When we got to the bar, I tried to excuse myself, said it was much later than I had thought. I would just take the cab and go home. I just wanted to leave Tomo and Master in peace to enjoy their evening.
"No, no," Ricky insisted. "One drink, or I will have only these to talk to."
"I am one. I am one. I am one," my brain shouted, but my vocal cords were frozen. Dazed, I went into the bar. We were greeted in the small entranceway by the most gracious hostess in full kimono, hair in a formal wig, adorned with hanging gold ornaments. She greeted Master eagerly.
"Irashai, Kochan!"
She called him the childhood nickname, reserved for family and closest friends. He blushed and averted his eyes. We were ushered into a small room with a few tables of geisha and a small stage. All the geisha rushed to greet Master and then turned to Tomo. "Who was this handsome one?" they asked Master. "Was he the famous piano player from Tokyo?" They fluttered and fawned, flipping Tomo's longish hair back from his eyes and leaving lipstick kisses on the Master's ears and cheek. How beautiful they were! How friendly! How happy he seemed! I smiled and bowed hello. They herded us to a table in front of a small stage and held the chairs. Master seated the prostitute between Tomo and himself. I sat next to Ricky. "Ridiculous," he whispered to me with disdain, but loudly enough for them to overhear. "Men who dress like women." My heart fell again. "No," I said, "they're quite beautiful." One of them fluttered by me.
"Drinku?"
She pantomimed a glass in perfect female fashion, left hand holding the bottom as her right hand tilted it. Every gesture in Japan in 1970 had a gender. Rather, the rigidity of sex roles defined all behavior to the smallest detail. Ritual and tradition held that men and women talked, walked, sat, ate, smiled, stood, drank, laughed, and for all I knew, slept differently. Men held their cups with one hand. Women always used two. Women always sat only on their knees. Men sat comfortably cross-legged. Women in kimono took small, quick steps, heel in front of toe, all in a line. Men swaggered, slightly bow-legged. Women's heads tilted, chins back, eyes down. They rarely looked at you directly. Their hands flew to their mouths when they laughed, which was always a giggle or a shy titter, rarely robust. Women's motions were choreographed, graceful, their hands slightly cupped,
fingers together, except for the index finger which extended. They served and gathered the long sleeves of their kimono in perfect synchronicity. In their perfect female motion, I had forgotten that they were men. Then the wonder of it struck me, their grace, their poise, their exquisite gesture. I sat mesmerized, waiting for something that would give their real identities away. I had forgotten about Master and Tomo and the prostitute. Our drinks were served, and the geisha said there would be a fan dance. Ricky spoke. Disgusting to be like women. His disdain was not simply for queers, but for women, too. I ignored his remark and turned to watch the dance. I had expected some Vegas show tune with ostrich fans and bare legs. This was not Takarazuka, I reminded myself, the all-female review where Japanese girls swooned over the women who dressed like men. This was a queer bar in the Kansas of Japan. The traditional music scratched on the record player. The dancer in a pale green kimono with chrysanthemum pattern, trim and train, with a pale yellow obe, holding a single, simple hand fan, moved center of stage in a thin spot of light. The dance was entirely in her hand, the motion of the fan and the movement of her head and shoulders. Her hands were smooth and small, her makeup flawless, her gesture perfect. There was only one small clue. In the lovely open neckline of kimono, she couldn't hide her Adam's apple, except in the exquisite motion of the fan. When the fan was open and up, the illusion was perfect. When it moved, was there the briefest shadow at the center of her throat? I sat transfixed. She finished to cheers and applause. I heard myself call, "Brava!" Ricky ordered another drink and began to slur his disparaging words. Tomo and Master still sat with the woman between them, hands and heads together, whispering in front of her, oblivious. She sat quiet and ignored, eyes down. It was too much. The pretense was too much for me, for Tomo and Master, and for the young woman who sat between them. Ricky put his hand on my knee, the gesture of a man with too much drink. "Judy," I stammered. "My friend is coming to Japan. We will live together." I paused. He moved his hand to my thigh. Judy and I, we are like this," I said and dropped my eyes. "No," he said, failing to understand. No, these are not real women. "I know, Chigayamas," I said, "different. I don't mean that." I hadn't the language to come out in English, let alone Japanese, and he hadn't the training to listen, let alone unravel my conversation. "You woman, I man, let's go someplace." "No, I have to go home." "Let's go there, then." "No, I'll go alone." "You mustn't go alone, it's late." "It's fine, I'll take a cab." "It's dangerous." "It isn't dangerous, I always leave alone." "Chotto, sumimasen, please excuse me." I rose and spoke to the master. "Domo, shitsurei shimasu, watakushi ikimasu." "Excuse me, please, I'm sorry to interrupt, I'm gonna go." "Domo, arigato gozaimasu, totemo ii, watashi. My Japanese failed me. "Thank you very much. Everything was lovely, but... Ja, oyasumi." "Well, good night." He smiled and spoke to Ricky in Japanese. "Ie, daijoubu desu ne," I interrupted. No, I'm okay. I can take taxi. Honto, really, daijoubu desu, it's okay." I bowed and moved toward the exit. Ricky followed me. The hostess smiled as I entered the hallway. "Sumimasen ga, taxi ga arimasen ka?" "Excuse me, but isn't there a taxi?"
"Hai, chotto matte kudasai, arimasu yo."
"Sa, Nihongo jōzu desu ne."
"Yes, of course, just a minute. We'll get you a taxi." "My, your Japanese is very good." "Iie," I protested. She turned to the bouncer and asked him to get a cab. It seemed an eternity standing, silent but smiling. The bouncer returned.
"Takushi, koko."
The language was rough and guttural. I bowed slightly to the hostess and fled into the brisk night and the open door of the taxi. "Sadai kansha," I told the driver. "University complex." Either I hadn't been clear, or he hadn't expected to understand me. I had to speak again, more formally. Ricky used the opportunity and slid in.
"Mo, keko de gozaimasu, daijoubu desu."
No, thank you. It's okay. Master said Una will worry. Where do you live?
Sadae Kansha, I said.
Sadae Kansha, he told the driver.
Hi.
I tried to pay attention so I could find the bar again. But the streets were unfamiliar, and the driver seemed to be making unnecessary turns. Ricky was drunk and pawing. I kept his hands from moving further by holding one on my thigh and the other on my shoulder. Were men always the same? When we got to my neighborhood, I gave the cabbie directions in Japanese, which he understood. He pulled up in front of the main gate. I scrambled out and slammed the door before a wobbling Ricky could slide across the seat. I handed the driver 500 yen, which he refused, nodding to Ricky. I ducked through the low opening into the courtyard, closed the wooden gate, and ran across the sand, lit only by moonlight, past the twisted pines, neatly latched gates, and dark houses of my neighbors, to my own gate, which I always left open. I turned, latched the weather wooden door in the stone wall behind me, and bounded up the steps, skeleton key to my house, the foreign teacher's house, ready in my hand. Inside, I relocked the door and peered through the curtain. The cab sat in the street for several minutes. I imagine the savvy driver was dissuading his drunken passenger from making a fool of himself. Finally, the headlights backed out the narrow street, and the main gate of the nine-house compound remained closed. I sat up in bed for a long time, blankets pulled around my shoulders. I wanted Judy to be there. I wanted to tell Master I was sorry for disturbing his evening. I wanted to tell him how much I loved being with the geisha, how warm and friendly they were. But we never spoke about the night at the Gayobaru. Though sometimes, after Judy arrived, I thought the smile in his eyes might be a blessing. Faulkner was a large, jovial man. He'd been a friend of my mother and dad since high school, when he and Dad were in drama club together. He was a theater aficionado. I didn't know what a theater queen was then. I was very sheltered. Mac inherited the Chevrolet dealership when his father died, made a good living selling Chevys in a working-class GM town. He was personable and probably a wonderful salesman. He had a good memory for details and an easy laugh. Long after my mother divorced my dad, she and Mac dated. I use quotation marks because they merely went out together to formal events that required a partner of the opposite sex. Mac never married, my mother never remarried, and neither of them went out seriously with anyone else. They also never went out casually, and Mac never just dropped by the house. They went to their 25th and 30th class reunions together, dinner dances, local theater performances, and special events that wouldn't have welcomed singles. Mac also took my mother to nearly every play I was in, from Camelot to Tom Jones. He loved the theater, especially leading ladies. He made a major production of the gifts he brought me on opening night. Usually it was something he made himself. I still have the black and white photos of me in costume he cut from the high school yearbook and mounted on swizzle sticks with hand-lettered billboards. He stuck them in a cake he'd baked. The billboard read, "From Camelot to Camille." On another swizzle stick, he taped a photo of Garbo as Camille but pasted my head on it. It read, "Next season, Linda T. as Camille." Mac was flamboyant. He loved to come to Madison Summer Theater, a blue and white striped circus tent east of town on a lot owned by the lumberyard. He wore a tuxedo and white gloves. All the other men wore sport jackets and knit shirts with no ties, or short-sleeved permapress shirts. Ties, no jackets. I had no idea how to respond to Mac, to his enthusiasm, to his wardrobe, and no appreciation of his generosity and personal attention. I was 17 and self-absorbed, especially when it came to acting. Acting was my life. The theater was the only place I felt safe and comfortable.
slipping in and out of character, more natural than breathing. Being on stage with someone else's emotions, far easier than living my own. Though I didn't know that then. I couldn't see what I possibly had in common with Mac, who had given up acting for selling cars and being on the board of the Civic Theater instead of trotting the boards, as he loved to say. If he loved the theater that much, how could he give it up? Like I said, I was 17, and Mac did get back into acting after I left town. He was quite good, I heard, especially in roles by Noel Coward. My mother described him as a perfect gentleman who made her feel special. He dressed well, took her to expensive restaurants, brought her gardenias, which she loved, and never came on to her. Mac was a kind of buffer between Mother and me during my last year of high school and the summer before I went to college. She liked the attention she got when her daughter had a lead role in town, especially when she had a date with Mac instead of my grandmother. When she went out with Mac, she got all fluttery and giddy. She seemed helpless and femme, so retiring and passive. Otherwise, she wanted me home as soon as the curtain rang down. Now, Mac occupied her time and chided her to remember how they'd partied as high school friends and how important it was. On nights she went out with Mac, she wasn't sitting in the dark in the kitchen waiting for me, the only indication of her presence, the red-orange tip of her cigarette glowing in sync with her long, audible drags. I always knew how angry she was by the length of time the glow was visible. The longer the drag, the deeper the anger. Sometimes the drag was so deep and the ember so bright it lit up her stony face. Then her eyes, piercing, seemed to blaze as well. I'd try to make it in the front door and across the few feet to my bedroom before the red-orange fire went out. She couldn't inhale and berate me at the same time. Sometimes I'd enter the dark, silent house, hesitate at the door, eyes toward the kitchen looking for the glow, listening for her breathing. Hearing nothing, relieved that she must be asleep, I'd walk to the kitchen for a glass of water or a snack. Then I'd hear it, the familiar deep suck of air through the cylinder of tobacco, and I'd see where there had been pitch black, the red-orange ember. Now I couldn't escape to my room. Where have you been? Rehearsal. Where'd you go after? Nowhere. I came straight home. Straight home? Yes. Who'd you go with? Sandy. She drove her mother's car. What boys were you with? None. Doesn't Sandy see Bradley? What boys were you with? We weren't with any boys. How can you do this to me, lie to me like this? I'm not lying, Mother. I wasn't with any boys. Sandy drove. I had to put away the props and lock the auditorium. We were last ones to leave. I wasn't with any boys. You're lying. You're pregnant. I'm not. I'm not. By then I was in tears. I have to be both mother and father to you children. You will not lie to me. I never understood her accusations. I could only assume that fathers who cared about their daughters questioned them in the same way. At least when she went out with Mac, she forgot about me for a while. His presence protected me somehow. He encouraged me to go to New York, to live my dreams, in ways I thought he hadn't. He said there'd be no future in White River for someone like me. I thought he meant for someone with my talent. Perhaps that was part of it. My mother might have continued to date Mac if she hadn't reacted so violently to his apartment. He invited her to a dinner party. She was excited to go. She spent weeks worrying about what to wear. He was introducing her to his friends. She came home angry, disgusted, that he had asked her to go there with them. I couldn't get any details about who they were, except they were male friends of Mac's from Indianapolis, and that his place was awful. What was so awful about it? I imagined roaches, peeling paint, unwashed dishes, and unmade beds. No, it was filled with expensive bric-a-brac, Waterford crystal, bone china, antique Queen Anne chairs covered in powder blue velvet, and a pink bathroom. Pink! And he had makeup, CoverGirl foundation in the dressing table. I asked why she was looking in the drawers of the dressing table. She said she had forgotten her comb, and Mac told her there was one in the dressing table. Maybe he has zits or a birthmark or cuts himself shaving. She cut me off. But the worst part, she was nearly apoplectic, were the strings of beads hanging in the doorway between the hallway and the bedroom instead of a proper door. She shuddered. She wouldn't say what it meant to her directly, but I had a vague feeling in my gut. There was something implicitly sensual about moving through strings of beads. And sensuality, the Siamese twin of sexuality, horrified my mother. I liked this man and tried to plead his case. Well, he told you to look in the dressing table. Obviously, he keeps things there for his guests. He doesn't have female guests. You were there. Maybe someone else left it. It wasn't working. I changed my tack. He isn't theater, after all. Of course he has makeup. But she stopped going out with him because it was too embarrassing to be seen with someone who acted like that. I missed Mac. He stopped coming by the house, though he came occasionally to the plays at the tent. He always sent notes. Break a leg, doll. Mac. Mac died in 1983. Long after Judy and I had moved to Boston, after I'd fled to Japan and returned ready to love her, after I'd lost her and written a play about two young women who lived in a bed. By then I knew who I was and who Mac was. My mother had come to the San Francisco premiere, but she never told Mac about my play. She didn't tell any of her friends. What would they think about the mother of someone who acted like that? She did tell me that Mac died. Mac Faulkner died, she said as an afterthought on one of my visits home. They found him in a bathroom in a theater in Indianapolis. At least he had the decency not to do it in town. Do what? Die? What happened? I cried. Heart attack, she said. How humiliating to die alone in a bathroom in Indianapolis. Sad, I thought. Not humiliating. Wasn't anyone with him? I asked, disbelieving. No, she insisted. He was alone when he died. Strangers found him after intermission. My heart broke. Someone must have been there. After all, he had friends in Indianapolis. But did he go to the theater alone? He always partied with people. Well, his friends were there, but he had gone to the bathroom alone. Then, from what was so vehemently denied, I gleaned the truth. He wasn't alone. If he was with an usher, the conductor, the attractive man third row center, Mac wasn't alone. How sad, I thought. A man like Mac going to Indianapolis for anonymous sex? Then I rethought it. Mac Faulkner, age 61, attractive, 6'2" tall, 280 pounds, died of a heart attack during intermission in a bathroom in a theater in Indianapolis. I'll bet he was wearing a tuxedo. It was perfect. Ecstasy at intermission. A dramatic exit for White River's grandest theater queen. Mac had lived and died on his own terms, even in White River, and no one could deny it.